Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Inside College Soccer. We've had a trend. We've been interviewing our staff. You know, it's crazy that as I think about the nearly 300 years of combined experience in college that our staff has as a whole, we don't talk about it very much. We don't talk about where our staff has been, what schools they've been at. The guy I've got now has probably coached at more Power Five schools maybe than anybody in the country. Played at one, fellow goalkeeper. Love to have you in, Ernie Yarborough. How are you, brother?
I'm doing well, Don. Thanks for having me today. Always a pleasure to talk about soccer and the journey and playing in college. I think that was an experience that changed my life, and really happy now to have the chance to help others have that opportunity. So being able to talk about my journey, where it's taken me, how we've gotten here, and all things along the way, and now what's the future? I think those are some great things to talk about today, and hopefully find a way to help people make those decisions moving forward.
Yeah, it is changing. Now, you and I have known each other a little while. Let's see, I think we met, I came to Feather River in 2010, and I want to say we met maybe the year after that. I was promoting our players, our junior college players.
Sure.
And I think you were at...
I was at IU around there.
Yeah.
I was at IU at the time.
IU at the time.
And then I remember getting some of the information there. And then as well, when I went down to Stetson, you had a couple guys for us when I was at Stetson as well. And that was, those were kind of the ones that were more likable for us in the situation that you were looking for and where we were putting players at the time to revamp the roster and everything. But yeah, so it's been over 10 years, that's for sure. And then the opportunity came just about the time of COVID to start helping people with what you're doing now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been great though, because we, let's see. And then I think I thought originally you introduced me to Andre. Andre reminded me in his episode that he and I had met doing the same thing. I was trying to promote our players from Feather River.
I've known Andre since I was 18 years old.
Isn't that crazy?
Came into Indiana University in the same recruiting class, playing the same position. So there's a little history there in terms of competitiveness between the two of us at a younger age. But certainly over the years have a mutual respect for each other and what we've done, and certainly now what we're doing. I was just hanging out with him, 10 days ago at the IU camp. Had some time to talk both past, present, and, you know, obviously, again, talking about the future of where the game is now and where it's going, and talking to the coaches that are there and figuring out the best way to help people moving forward.
So are you an Indiana boy born and bred?
No, actually, I have a journey that goes all the way through my life. I've changed places quite a bit. I grew up on what is known as the Jersey Shore. Not quite what MTV played it as in the early 2000s. What I like to tell people is it was like that, but not for TV. It was a good time growing up. I grew up between, Atlantic City and Cape May. So down south, in a town called Avalon. It was a barrier island. We had about 2,000, 3,000 people in the winter and 25 or 30,000 in the summer. So, you know, obviously a summer town. And it was interesting because you basically had two lives, to be honest. You had your summer friends who would come from out of town and be there for 3 or 4 months and, you know, really got to know a different group of people. And then you obviously had your friends who lived there, you went to school with, and you'd see them for 9 or 10 months. Yeah, you'd see them in the summer here and there. But the reality was they had summer friends that, you know, they knew before I was there. And so I grew up there.
What were your parents doing there? What were they doing in Avalon?
So my father's from that area. He went to Mainland High School and Ocean City High School, which is in that local area. And he was working at a burger restaurant in the summer. And my mom was a waitress, and she was a summer friend from Philadelphia area. She was on the main line in Philadelphia, went to Lower Merion, which is where Kobe Bryant went to high school, for point of reference. And so she was down there, you know, doing the summer thing, and they met. And he eventually moved up there with her, and I was born in Philadelphia. And when I was 2 or 3 years old, my father convinced her somehow to move down to the shore. And so they moved to Avalon in 1976, I believe. you know, and kind of got in on the front end of all the casinos coming and different, you know, I've got stories of, you know, them being asked to invest vast sums of money in things that they'd never heard of that eventually, you know, some people did and made a lot of money because, you know, you invest in Resorts International at the right time. You know, it's kind of like getting Apple before it became Apple. But they moved into kind of that era of the late 70s when that was coming. We lived there until 1987, when we moved to Florida. So I was 14 years old. We moved to Orlando, Florida. And I went to a high school called Dr. Phillips, which is right across the street from what is now Universal High School, or sorry, Universal Studios. And you can actually, there are parts of my high school where you can sit in a classroom and watch people ride roller coasters. There are literally windows that look across the street, Harry Potter's castle. You know, you sit in our football stadium and Harry Potter's castle is right across the street. One story I like to tell is kind of funny. After I graduated in 1991, I went, you know, I'd go back and watch soccer matches. And we were playing one of the more inner city schools of Orlando one time at home. And I'm in the stands watching. And literally, as the ball hit the, so my high school scores, and as the ball hit the back of the net's exploding in the background. And above the net in the background is the Universal Studios stunt show going off. And there are
That's
fireworks
amazing.
and the fire and the bang and, you know, all the fans from the other school that, you know, is not, you know, as well off, I guess, to say, as our high school would be. We're like, can you believe it? They have fireworks when they score goals here. What is that all about? Blah, blah, blah. And you know, we had to remind them that was
That's
a clear
great.
coincidence. But
That's
those
great.
types of things are pretty funny to talk about with our high school. But had a great experience in Orlando. That's really kind of where the soccer part came to be. I grew up sailing, soccer, baseball, basketball, golf, you know, anything I could do to keep my mind racing in the winters and summers in Avalon as a kid. And then when I got to Florida, I was a really good baseball player and soccer player, pretty good golfer as well. That's probably the one that's probably the one I should have gone after to make the money for sure. But got into the soccer side of things about my sophomore year. The baseball coach came and was like, "Hey, we got tryouts coming in Florida. Soccer is a winter sport, so it overlaps with the tryouts of baseball in the spring, obviously." And he was kind of pressuring me to come out for the baseball team, and I was starting on the varsity soccer team at the time. And I just said, "You know what? I'm really getting into the soccer side of things." I wasn't a fan of his, to be honest. And I don't think that the baseball thing was going to allow me to play at the highest level the way soccer was at the time. You know, for various reasons, I was the kid that came in out of nowhere and, you know, kind of had to beat out all the kids that were there for years before me. And, you know, politics and sports, as we know, is very real. And so I was like, you know what? I'll just stick with the soccer. They're giving me a chance. And so I finished my sophomore year, and then I went to Europe that summer with a regional team. And that's really where the love affair began. We went to Holland, Belgium, and Denmark, for some tournaments and some training. I actually was chosen to go on a national team to Russia at the time. Well, at the time, the Soviet Union. They picked a team of, you know, people from all the different groups we had and wanted to send one main team over to Minsk, to their training center. And unfortunately, my group left like a week or two after the main groups. And so my paperwork couldn't get processed fast enough. And so I was not available to go to that trip. But thankfully, the week they went was the week that my team was in Amsterdam. So I'm very happy that I got to hang out in Amsterdam for a week as opposed to Minsk, Soviet Union. But it was a good time. Met a lot of good friends and
So back in the
really.
days, Ernie, when ODP was the pathway to the national team,
Yeah.
it was the main pathway for the country. So if someone, for our listeners, they won't believe us, but if you were on your regional team,
Yeah.
as a goalkeeper, you were probably one of the top 10 in the country. You were always in
Yeah,
consideration.
I don't
Do we
know if
bring
this
him
was
into the
a.
national camp? Do we not bring him in? Which
Yeah,
ones
for
do we
sure.
pick? Which ones don't? But you're in the conversation if you're in the regional pool of, is there anybody from this group that we should bring up to the
Oh,
national camp?
sure. Yeah, it was a great opportunity. You know, I really did well. We played the youth team from Napoli when Diego Maradona was part of that setup. We played a German Regionalia team from Bavaria. You know, they came out with the green kits and the whole thing. And, you know, we lost that one in the last second, unfortunately. I have a bad memory of them piling up right next to me on the field, you know, cheering and chanting and everything that goes with it. But some great memories. And it really opened my eyes to kind of what football was. You know, I mean, we say soccer here, obviously, but you know, you learned about the culture. You know, we were in Holland a year after they won the Euros. So everything was, you know, centric around Ruud Gullit, Marco van Basten, you know, all those guys, Koeman and Rijkaard and that group that played in the late 80s, early 90s that were dominant, you know, across Europe. And so really got into it, became a Liverpool fan through Bruce Grobbelaar, the goalkeeper that was there at the time.
The really crazy man.
Well, yeah, he was Zimbabwe, so no one really knows who he was.
He was the most eccentric goalkeeper of the time. Yes.
He was. My father for Christmas one year got me a video, you know, like a biographical video of his. And it really kind of showed me a different side of the position, I guess, as you just said. You know, one of the things he's famous for is, I think it was in the 84 European Cup final, you know, they went to PKs against Roma and he's in there, you know, shimmying and acting like the clown. And, you know, guys miss, you know, as you know, being a goalkeeper and penalty kicks are very psychological. And so, you know, either side of that equation are always trying to find a way to heads up the other guy. And so he found a very good way. And so, you know, Brad Friedel, when I was a junior in high school, I went to the Final Four in Tampa. And Brad Friedel was very good at that. He had a huge wingspan. He was very tall. Recall him standing in the goal, and he would make himself an X, and he would reach up and grab the goalpost and basically cover, you know, a third of the goal just by standing there. And Rutgers, you know, missed two or three, I think, in that shootout. And so there are various ways to do it. You know, you see Emi Martinez doing his little, you know, shake and bake after he makes a save, or you see a goalkeeper go up and hand the ball to a shooter and, you know, eye him up. And so, yeah, so I was very, very entertained by Bruce Grobbelaar and his story. And through that became a Liverpool fan. The unfortunate part of that was the timing, because that's right about when Liverpool started to backslide, if you will. And so the 90s and the 2000s were a little bit rough being a Liverpool fan. But
yeah, I tell you what, Ernie, after Arsenal stole the title from them in 1988, they were never the same again. Yeah,
they weren't.
It took them a while to
that
recover.
That was part of the video, actually, where they talked about, you know, the guy instead of, and this is as a coach now, I can use this as an example. You know, all he had to do was go to the corner, you know, with a minute left in the last game of the season. Instead, he tries to score. And I think it was Andy Cole went down the other end and scored for Arsenal and wins them the title. You know, I mean,
crazy.
We had a situation like that a couple of years ago with one of the teams that I worked with at the Indy Fire, now Indy 11. We're in a national championship. They're winning the game by one goal. I think it was U15 at the time. The best player on the team, you know, has the ball at the top corner of the 18. And instead of just going down to the end line and icing it, he decides to turn and go to goal. And the team, you know, he shot it right at the keeper or something, and the keeper throws it out, and they get a corner, and they score on the corner, and they go to overtime, and they lose. And it's just a hard lesson to learn. I mean, but it happens at every level, as we see, even at the top
absolutely
level.
Absolutely, yeah. Happened to us in a college playoff game. Executed the first short one perfectly. The players decided to do it differently the second time. They took the ball, went down, chipped the keeper from 40 yards out. Unbelievable. Yeah. Penalties, I mean, lose. It happens. Stuff.
Yeah, well, the flip side of that is in 2012 when I was working at Indiana University, and we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, but when we won the national championship, we're playing at North Carolina in a quarterfinal, and there's like 6-7 minutes left, and we put a guy on the field named Tim Wiley. He was a senior, fifth-year senior. He'd gone through the coaching change with Todd coming in. He'd been recruited by the former coach, Mike Freitag. Didn't play much. You know, was a fifth year guy, but he'd been around. He was he's what we call in the program a salty dog. You know, he'd been around and knows the ways of the program, and was very, very good as a leader as a fifth year. Again, probably played an average of 5 minutes a game, if that, all through the year. And so with about 5 minutes left, we put him on and we said, hey, you got to do the dirty work not to let him score a goal in the last 5 minutes. And no joke, Don, he went on the field and the ball never crossed half field again, right? He'd take a throw in and go stand on it in the corner. He'd take a short corner and go stand on it. The ball would get played out. We'd clear it in. He'd dribble it right to the corner. And so the exact opposite of what we're talking about is someone who understands the role, and regardless of his role within the team,
great
job. We won the game because a guy came in that did his job. You know, he understood his role, and you know, soccer's a big team sport, and understanding.
That's discipline, right? That's because it's emotional at those moments at the end of the game, and everybody's nervous. It's emotional.
Oh, sure.
And that's discipline. It's someone you can trust. They've been trained.
You know, we always talk about with players, you know, we trusted him to go do that. Right. You know, you have to have the right feeling. I mean, players are like, why did you put me into the game at this point? It's like, one, the game was really fast, and I didn't think you'd be able to catch up to the speed of the game and, you know, in the amount of time that we would need you. Or B, I don't trust you. I don't trust that you can go in the field and do what that guy did for 5 minutes, you know, and when you show it to him on video and you know, you break it down for the rest of the group. And these are our principles. These are the things that we have to have if we want to be successful. And I think in the long run, that's really where IU separates itself from a lot of programs, is they've got players throughout the roster who are older and more mature and have been brought through the right way. And that's the part of what we'll talk about later that kind of worries me the most, is you're not going to have many programs like that anymore. The ones and the duns and the transfers and the ability to leave when you want if it's not going your way. It's going to be very hard to build programs of quality as opposed to teams of quality.
Right.
And there's a big difference in those two things.
Absolutely.
Programs of quality create teams of quality. And the proof is in 50 years of success for that program.
Virginia
obviously can do it. Clemson can obviously do it. Stanford has done it, you know, with Jeremy now. And so there's a lot of things that go into it. There's no question about it. But at the end of the day, you have to have the ability to have players who can do it from the inside. You know, I'll never forget my freshman year. You know, I'm one of, you know, Andre included, one of five goalkeepers on the roster, and arguably the fifth one, because no one really knew who I was or where I was coming from or what I did. And, you know, one of the upperclassmen came by and he said, hey, look, the next 4 or 5 years of your life are going to be hard. They're going to be really hard. He's like, but if you can get through them, they'll be worth it every minute of the rest of your life.
Right.
And so, but you have to have someone in a third or fourth year position be able to tell you that, you know, and you have to, as a young player, buy into it, believe it, whatever you want, and go from there. But the reality is, I don't know how many programs are going to have too many of those guys anymore. And this was a guy that didn't play a lot. This was a guy that wasn't a regular starter, who had been there 3 years playing 90 minutes a game. You know, this was a guy who was arguably in a position that I was going to be in a couple years. And so, having the ability for some of these guys to be able to pass that information down, the best teams that win, you know this as a coach, the best teams that win are player driven.
Right.
They're not, we provide the car, you know, we provide the road, but they have to drive it. They have to guide it. They have to be the ones that make the right decisions on where to turn and take this thing once it gets going. And it usually happens, if it's a good group, it usually happens somewhere about halfway to 2/3 of the way through the season. That's when you can tell whether or not you have the right type of group to take you into the postseason and do well. That's really where IU, and if you look at IU over the years, they have some really bad starts. You know, they have a third or half the season where you're like, oh, this is the year they're not going to make the tournament. This is the year they're going to struggle. And then they'll go and win 10 of their last 12 or 10 of their last 10 and win the Big Ten tournament and go to a Final Four, you know?
Right.
And once, as you know, once you get to a Final Four, anything can happen. You know,
right.
I mean, the best team doesn't always win out of those four. And sometimes the best team does win, and it's a break. It's a call. It's an injury. I've seen it happen. I've seen the best team in the country undefeated lose in triple overtime. And I've seen the worst team of the Final Four win a national championship. I mean, firsthand, sitting on the bench. And so, you know, those things happen. And when I say worst team, I'm talking about talent top to bottom. No,
sure. Sure.
I think when it comes to intangibles, there's a lot different there, but
sure.
The reality is the best team on paper will say, doesn't always win. And to be able to have those things coming from the inside, the Tim Wiley story I mentioned earlier, they had five seniors. There were five seniors that were part of that team, and we won a national championship because of those five seniors. And I would say collectively among those five guys, maybe. So if you look at five guys, 90 minutes, let's call it 20 games. So 1800, you know, what's that? 1800 minutes each. You're looking at basically 14,000 minutes between them. I'd say maybe if they were lucky, they played 1,000 together.
Right.
They hardly ever saw the field, but they were the first ones at practice. They were the last ones to leave. When we'd go on the road and they didn't play, they were the first ones in the weight room, you know, riding the bikes and doing the workouts, making sure they're getting their fitness in. You know, if they didn't play, they'd take, you know, the younger guys who didn't play and they'd go on a 3 mile run. Like, they were just leaders and they wanted to win, and they didn't care that they played 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. They wanted to win, and they drove the ship. And they were fifth year guys. They'd been in the transition. They knew why there was a transition, and they didn't want to be the group that let the history down.
Right.
And that happens. And so I played in, you know, going way back now to the discussion, you know, my junior year, went to Europe. My summer between my junior and senior year, I went to IU soccer camp. You know, I thank my grandmother for that one, because I was in New Jersey. I was all set to go to Rutgers, you know, just go to camp right up the road. Rutgers was a great program at the time. Bob Riasso was coaching, and, you know, knew some guys that had played there. They'd been to the Final Four, and they were a top flight national level program. And so my plan was, you know, I was in New Jersey. I was going to go to Rutgers camp you know, for the week. But I really wanted to go to IU. You know, they had sent some information and said, hey, if you can come, you know, we'd love to see you. But you live in Florida, so it's tough to recruit down there. And, you know, maybe it was a general camp invite the way we see them now. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But I went to camp because my grandmother said, hey, if your parents will pay for camp, I'll pay for you to get there. And so, you know, we were going to pay for camp anyway. So we took care of that. She paid the couple hundred dollars to fly me out there. And I had a really good week. You know, I played with and against some of the best players in the country within their program, as well as who was on staff. One of the things that was happening quite a bit back then was, you know, we'd train from 9 to 11, let's say, in the morning. And then from 11:15 to noon, they would have a staff game. They would, you know, 10, 15 players that were working or coaches that were working would come up and they'd get two goals together. And, you know, they'd play, you know, 6-a-side, 7-a-side, whatever the numbers were. And they only had one goalie from the staff that would play. So they're like, hey, we need a keeper. And I was like, all right, I'll stick around and play. And so I was playing basically with and against some of the best players in the country, just, you know, kind of casually. And one of the things at the time, I was playing at home in Florida when I went to that trip to Europe. One of the coaches had a men's team in the league in Orlando. And so he basically was like, hey, I need a goalkeeper. And I said, all right, I'll play, whatever. And so I went on this men's team and they were bad. You know, they were back in the day, the men's leagues around basically had, you had an English team and you had a Haitian team and you had a German team and you had a Brazilian team and you had a, you know, a Mexican.
Yeah, you're talking about in between the years of pro soccer in the United States.
Well, exactly.
Right? And it was after the.
In Orlando, Florida at the time, it was a lot of expats. And so you had some legitimate ex-professionals, you know, Division One, Division Two guys, maybe not Premier League, but you definitely had some guys that were living in Central Florida who were former professional soccer players. And so I played, but our team was the mutts. So if you were English and you didn't make the English team, you played for us. If you were Brazilian and you make the Brazilian team, you played for us. So arguably we had players 18 to 22 from all those teams. And so they were always finishing toward the bottom. And the guy asked me to play. And I said, okay, no problem. Right. So I come in and the first year was my fall of my junior year. And we were in the bottom quarter of the league. You know, spring of my junior year, we went to the, you know, middle.
This is junior year of high school in Florida, right?
Yep. And so I'm 16, 17 years old, and I'm playing with 25 to 40-year-olds. And, you know, we play at the Central Florida Fairgrounds against the, you know, the Jamaican team, and half the field smelled like jerk, and the other half smelled like something that's legal in 30 states now.
All right.
Literally, like, there'd just be 1,000 fans. It was family siesta day, and you know, you're a kid, 16, 17 years old, and I go over at halftime and tell the coach, like, do I have to switch ends? It smells really good down here. I want to stay in this goal in the second half. For the jerk part, Don, for the jerk part.
Yeah, we know what you meant. Don't worry about it. It's okay.
It's just a great experience. And so, you know, when I get to IU and I'm playing with these guys, I'm very comfortable. You know, I wasn't thinking much about it. And by the time I played with them, I had 4 or 5 other coaches talking to me after the camp about wanting to go to their schools and, you know, getting recruited. So the IU camp really opened up some doors. Went back my senior year, fall of my senior year on that men's team. Now we're in the top half of the league. And what started to happen was you had now players from those other teams that were good. Maybe there were players 13 to 18 who weren't playing as much. They now came to us. So our roster started to improve. And literally by the time I finished my senior year, we won the league. We were the best team in the league. And that didn't really make too many people happy because obviously, you know, we were the ones that weren't supposed to be beating the ones that were the good players.
Sure.
And so it was a really fun experience, you know, and that's where I got good. You know, I played against good players who, you know, I wasn't playing high level club soccer. I wasn't in the USYS system as much as everybody else. I was one of those kids that was flying under the radar, if you will, in terms of club soccer. I played on bad teams in Orlando because my buddies played on them. And I, as a goalkeeper, honestly, I had no problem with that. Because
sure, you get lots of reps.
What's that?
You get lots of reps. You see a lot of experience.
Well,
you get a lot of experience. You see a lot more scenarios
than
if you're on a team
getting
shot on once a game.
And that's one of the things that I tell people about indoor. I played indoor as well at the time. And people are like, why? You know, what's the difference between indoor and outdoor and everything? I said, well, indoor soccer for goalkeepers is great because you see the ball a lot more.
More reps.
You have to more reps. But the thing with the thing for me with the men's team that was very good was I had to be good at other things, you know, communication, positioning, you know, leadership. Like you really had to kind of focus on helping the team be better. You know, what could I do as a goalkeeper to prevent the other team from having opportunities? What could I do to let the defenders trust me more?
Right.
The greatest compliment that I ever got, And it really took me about 6 months to finally figure out where it was coming from. But the greatest compliment I ever got was when the players would be walking off the field and they look back and they're like, hey, thanks. And I'm like, for what? And they're like, because you helped me play better today. And, you know, for a while it was like, all right, good. Yeah, no problem. Great. Thanks. And then I started to realize, like, I am helping them play better. Like, my communication and my ability to help them be in the right spots or make the right decision at the right time, that does help them play better, right? It helps the team.
Absolutely.
It helps me. I don't have to face as many shots or deal with as many issues. But at the end of the day, you're helping individuals become better players and become better in different environments. So for me, that was the greatest compliment I ever got. Not, hey, great save. Not, oh, I was an excellent distribution. Or, oh, you played really well. No, like, to me, if my players respected who I was and what I was doing and how I was helping them, that to me was the best part, because that I was part of the group. I was part of the team. I was part of the reason that we did really well. And that for me was important. And, you know, it took some time for me to figure it out. But then when I got to IU, so I get recruited, you know, all these schools, and it's my senior year. And I remember very specifically going out Christmas caroling with some of my friends. And I come home at, you know, 10 o'clock at night on a Friday. Not too long before Christmas, and I walk in and my father says, hey, there's a note on your door. And I said, oh yeah, what's that? You know, what's going on? He goes, the call you've been waiting for your whole life showed up, you know, came tonight. And so I'm like, all right, whatever. So I go to my door and there's a sign, you know, Don Rawson, Indiana University soccer, you know, here's his phone number, you know, give him a call. So call the next morning, you know, talk to Don Rawson and basically said they really liked me at camp. They had an opportunity available for me to come in if I wanted to walk on and potentially go there. And so they were going to come watch me play in my environment with my high school at a tournament after Christmas. And so basically he was telling me, like, hey, like, we're coming to watch you play. And if you do well, there's going to be an opportunity for you. And so, you know, went to the tournament. I guess I played well because it was down at FIU. Munga Ekitebi and Carl Kremser were the coaches at FIU at the time. They both recruited me very hard. Munga and I are very good friends to this day. Saw him a couple weeks ago at camp. And he was actually retelling the story about, oh, Ernie, we really wanted you to be a Panther. He's like, but you now have interest in Miami. You didn't want to live in Miami. And I did. I told him, I said, hey, Munga, I really like you. Carl, you got a great program. I said, but I can't live in Miami, Florida. It's not me. And so we were down at FIU playing, and Don came and watched, and we did well. And, you know, a couple weeks later, he invited me on a visit. And so we took the visit in March with my father, and, you know, it was an easy decision after that. You know, it was really funny. We walk into coach's office on the visit, and we're going to go to a basketball game that evening. And on coach's desk, Kenny Snow had won the National Player of the Year. So he had the Matt Kerman Trophy crystal ball sitting on his desk. And that same season, Jürgen Sommer had won the Golden Boot for the best goalkeeper in the country. And so he had that sitting on the desk. So he had these two awards, like, for the highest, you know, position in the country sitting on his desk. I'll never forget, my father and I walked out. He goes, Ernie, he goes, I'm a football guy. He goes, and that would be like walking into Notre Dame's football office and the Heisman Trophy was sitting on, you know, at the time, Lou Holtz's desk. He goes, but wait, you're a linebacker. So here, why don't you have the Butkus Award instead? And he's like, so literally, like, not only did they have the player of the year, like the best player in college soccer trophy sitting there, they had your positional best player of the year trophy sitting there. And so that was a very eye-opening experience, you know, walking into that. But I got to meet Jürgen Sommer on that visit, one of the nicest men I've ever met, and still really good friends with him. Had a great time on the visit, went on another visit as part of that trip. You know, I won't disclose that situation just because it's personal and I don't want to disparage any other program for not picking them. But at the same time, just knew kind of Bloomington was the right fit for me. And I wanted the challenge of winning at that level. You know, when it came down to the decision, the other program I went to was very capable of winning at the level they were. IU obviously was very capable of winning at the level they were. And I wanted to win a championship at the highest level I could. And, you know, whether I played a lot, didn't play a lot, I wanted to be part of that program. And so I chose to go to IU, and, you know, can't look back at this point. I think it was one of the best decisions I ever made. And so I jokingly tell people now with recruiting, I say, look, there are 10 schools. And this is when I'm working at some of the best schools in the country. I would look at someone and say, look, there are 10 schools in the country that I cannot tell you not to go to. I said the 8 Ivies, Stanford, because it's Stanford, and IU. And they kind of look at you like, well, IU isn't an Ivy, and it certainly isn't Stanford. Like, why would that be part of the list? And I said, because it's very hard for me to tell someone not to make the decision that I made that had such a positive impact on my life. You know, I'd be lying to them if I told them that, oh, you can't get this or, oh, you can't get that. And so, you know, I think, as you know, one of the big things that we are with our company is very honest with people. And so I try to be very honest with them about that. If IU is part of your decision, it's very hard for me to tell you not to do that. To the point where we've lost some recruits over the years, you know, I didn't talk people out of it. I didn't maybe suggest they go, but I definitely didn't talk them out of it the way I would talk them out of a Northwestern or a Duke, or some of these other high end academics that we were competitive with.
Right.
You know, I would sell our school against them, where in IU, you know, they provided me an opportunity to do things I wanted to do. They provided me an education. You know, he provided me an opportunity after graduation to get into the coaching side of things, which led me to meet my wife, and Bloomington's a town that we love. My father actually just, you know, retired there, so to speak. We just moved him into assisted living in Bloomington. So it's hard for me to talk that one down. Had a great experience, went in with Andre, you know, Todd Yeagley was a teammate freshman year, Brian Mazenoff, teammate freshman year. You know, most of that class, we had 18 guys come in together because they had just gone to the final four the year before, and they moved on to a very big class. A couple guys went to Europe to play. Steve Snow, Chad Deering, Jurgen Sommer was graduating. Ken Snow had graduated. He got into the Alphabet Soup League of the early 90s here. So they were losing a lot of very good players. So they brought in a large class. redshirted my freshman year. Went back my sophomore year, and about halfway through the season, you know, don't want to put it this way, but kind of beat out Andre. He was the starter at the time. You know, I came on as the starter in the second half of the season. Got injured in my first game, my very first game against Wisconsin. Got injured. It was an old injury that I had in high school that reacted again. Was out for a couple weeks, and I thought, there's my shot. You know, I got here. I finally got my opportunity, and I get injured, you know, and I can't play for, I think it was like three games at the end of the season. And sure enough, as soon as I was healthy again, put me right back in. We went to Miami at FIU, of all places. Played really well again. Got a win and a tie, I think, out of that trip, maybe two wins. Got into the Big Ten tournament, won the Big Ten tournament at home, and then went to an NCAA quarterfinal and lost on the road to San Diego. And so that was my second year. I got my surgery for the injury finally after the season, and unfortunately in the spring didn't play as much as I wanted to. The goalkeeper that came in the year behind me, his name was Scott Sofel. He was very good, very athletic, big kid out of Wisconsin. He and I were battling for the position, and, you know, my sophomore eligible season, we basically played, you know, equally in the preseason, and he won the job. You know, fair credit to him. I made a mistake here or there that weren't, you know, timely, if you will, in our position. And as you know, one guy gets to play. It's not like there's three midfielders or four center or four backs.
Until
that guy makes a mistake, and damn it if we didn't win like 60 of our next 65 games. You know,
right. We
went on a streak those three seasons, 93-94, where basically we were unstoppable, you know. And really, when I started working at IU with Mays and Todd, we looked back at our 4 years, you know, together, and in the 4 years, we lost a total of 10 games.
And that's incredible. Think about
it, we lost one in the Big Ten tournament against Penn State, and then four of them would have been in the NCAA tournament because we didn't win. We lost in the final.
Right.
And so literally we had five losses in 4 years in the regular season. Like
that's incredible.
In college soccer, that's a pretty high level achievement.
It's a high run at any level.
And so there was no place to replace the goalkeeper, unfortunately. Right. And so I was back up for a few years, but I loved it. You know, people were like, why don't you transfer? You could play anywhere. I'm like, because it's IU. I don't need to transfer. I had a great experience. The town was great. The school was great. The program was great. I was playing every day with some of the best players in the country and enjoying it. And, you know, people were like, how are you so comfortable when you showed up? You know, you weren't in that team with these guys and blah, blah. I said, because going back to the men's league, I would say the oldest guy at IU was years younger than the youngest guy that I was used to playing with. You know, a 22, 23-year-old senior at IU, he was nothing on a men's league team. You know, those guys were 24, 25 at the earliest. And then like I said, they'd go up to 35 or 40 in some cases. So I was very comfortable. You know, I just loved playing. Like for me, it was strap on the boots, throw on the gloves. I didn't care who I was playing against. You know, when I was coaching there in the late 90s, Dima Kovalenko, Lexi Carroll, Yuri Lavinenko, Lazo Alvani, Chris Klein, all these guys would take you out, and basically you were their shot dummy, you know, going into goal and having to take all their chances. And coach, I have two bags of balls. I score 15 balls on you. You know, we'd wager, you know, and, you know, have challenges. And it was just great. I just loved playing. Like that was it for me. And so IU finished up, got into coaching in Indianapolis for a year, went around to some teams, tried out for different stuff, had an opportunity Nuno Patero down in Charleston wanted me to come play for the Battery at the time. They were very competitive. Mike Anheuser from IU was playing down there, and so I went down there and trained for a while. Things were going really well, but I wanted to be in Indiana, so I wanted to go there and play, and then come back and kind of stay in Indiana for a while. And they wanted to give me a job and move down there, and so I chose not to go. And then Indiana started a team the following year, and so I played with them for a year and a half, 2 years, and that's when Coach Yeagley, you know, introduced the opportunity to come back and be a grad assistant.
Right.
In 97. So I went down there in 97 in the fall, and we went to the Final Four as an undefeated team, 25-0, playing UCLA in Richmond. And a kid from Indiana scored on us in triple overtime. A kid from North Central, right down the street from where I live now, actually. But McKinley Tennyson Jr., very good player. I would say we semi-recruited him at IU at the time. He was a character. And so there were some issues with whether he'd fit in properly with us or not. But he ended up going to UCLA and, you know, beat us in overtime. And so that was 97. 98, 99, fortunately, we got all the way back and won the national championship both of those years. And that was an experience because 98, we were clearly the best team. We top to bottom, we had talent through the team, no question about it. You know, if that team hadn't won, it would have been upsetting, especially after what had happened in 97. 99, not quite the same. 99, we lost a few of those guys from that 98 team. We were struggling about a third of the way through the season. And I can remember very succinctly Coach Yeagley saying, you know, Dima's not walking through the door. You know, Chris Klein's not walking through the door. Lazo's not walking through the door. And so we had to really kind of revamp, you know, who we were. And that group, you know, again, player driven, player led from the inside. They got their act together about a third of the way through the season, realized that they were not the same team as the year before. We weren't going to win on, you know, paper the way we did the year before, you know, from the year before. And they made a nice run. You know, they really won the Big Ten tournament. They ended up getting through the playoffs and going to the Final Four in Charlotte. Beat a really good UCLA team in the semifinal. Nick Armando was in goal for that one. Beat them in overtime this time. And then we beat a really good Santa Clara team in the final. And so that group won twice. That allowed me the opportunity then to get a full, or a, I won't say a full-time job, a paying job at the University of Michigan. They were just starting their program in the summer of 2000. I had met Steve Burns a few times when he was coaching the Michigan Bucks. He'd come down to IU and look at players for the summer league USL team. So we had chatted a few times. And when he got the head coaching job there, he called and we chatted a little bit. He brought me up in May of 2000 to kind of look around and see what was going on with the program and what they were expecting and what they wanted to do. And got hired in June, moved with my girlfriend at the time, future wife, up to Ann Arbor in July, and started at the University of Michigan. And it was an interesting dynamic because if you think about the way things actually were at the time, we had just won the national championship with IU. So you're literally standing at the top of the college soccer mountain, right?
Right.
You'd go no further in the game. And here I was the next season, and I was starting a varsity program at the University of Michigan.
Right.
So I was literally
at the bottom.
I was in the parking lot.
Literally.
You know, not only at the bottom. It wasn't a team that had played the year before, not done well. We had no team. And so we basically started with, you know, the typical club to varsity transition. We had about half the roster were club guys, half the roster were recruited, you know, either freshmen or in-state kids that transferred or whatever.
Sure.
And we got off the mark, and within 3 years, we were in the Big Ten final. Within 4 years, we're playing at Santa Clara in the quarterfinals to go to the Final Four. And the program's really never looked back since then. And so
amazing.
Having the opportunity to go from the excellence of what college soccer is to kind of the building of excellence of college soccer, really allowed for a lot of growth in what I was doing as a coach, what I was doing as a recruiter, the types of people you were talking to. The game was different. There's no question. As you mentioned, ODP was very big back then. State cups and regionals and nationals were very big back then. Not to say they're not now, but they're not as big.
It's not the same. It's not the same.
They were. And so, you know, I've coached through those transitions. I've recruited through those transitions. So I quite understand everything about all of what's going on with the game. But Michigan was a great opportunity to grow and learn. When that opportunity was kind of waning itself after seven seasons, Mike Gettman at UAB offered me an opportunity to come down there and kind of learn with him. He was the coach at Harvard when I was getting recruited. So I had known Coach Gettman since I was 18 years old. As an IU grad himself, was very aware of what he was doing at UAB with the program. You know, Coach Yeagley was very good at reminding us all of what IU players were doing around the country, different programs and different things. And so Coach Getman's success in Birmingham was a big thing around our program. Was talking to Jay Vidovich at Wake at the same time and, you know, chose to go to Birmingham. You know, my wife and I went down for a visit. We really enjoyed the city. We really enjoyed Coach Getman and his family. The program was great. The guys were great. And so we made the decision to move down to Birmingham and we're very happy there. And probably would have stayed longer had a unique situation not developed where Todd Yeagley, got the job at Wisconsin. And my wife and I had always said, even before this, that if the opportunity ever came to live in Wisconsin, that was one of the places that we would look at. Because we always enjoyed going there to play. We always enjoyed going there when I was coaching, you know, going to Wisconsin and spending time there. And more than anything, every person I knew from Wisconsin, I really liked, you know, all the players and the families. I mean, Scott Soffel, the guy that I competed against, he was from Wisconsin and his family and the players we had in the late '90s when I was at IU from Wisconsin. Like, I just really liked the people. I really enjoyed kind of what they were about. My wife's German, background. So she obviously got along with kind of the culture of that place. And so when Todd got the job at Wisconsin and we were chatting, you know, one of the things I told I've known Todd obviously for, you know, at that point, 15 years or so. And I said to him at the end of the conversation, I said, look, Todd, it's real easy. I said, you can hire me. And when you assign me something to do, you know, it's going to get done and you know, it's going to get done in a certain way at a certain level and the tweaks will be minimal. I said, or in your first head coaching job, you can now have a younger coach that you have to monitor and tell how to do and look over their shoulder and spend time doing that. And as soon as I said that to him, he goes, all right, you're my guy. He's like, we need to get this worked out. Because it was basically like, look, you're going into a very important opportunity here. Where do you want to spend your time? Do you want to have someone you can trust and get done what you need to get done? Or do you want to be teaching this person in the role? And I think that helped him understand kind of very quickly, like I was able to do a lot of the things that he didn't want to do or have to do. And so he hired me at Wisconsin and we went up there with Keith T. Meyer and Chris Monroe at the time. And we had a really good experience in that 1 year. Unfortunately for Mike Freitag, another friend of mine in the coaching world, he was getting let go at IU at the end of that season. And so Todd came in and said, hey, look, I'm interested in the job. Full disclosure, I'm going to go for it. And if I get it, I want you guys to come with me. And so he went through the process like anybody else. You know, you're going to hear stories of, oh, dad,
sure.
You're
from dad, and there's dad. Nepotism like, stories out there and all that.
I can tell you that Todd Yeagley is very worthy of being the IU soccer coach.
He's proved it. That's the silly. It's like, what more does he need to do to prove it? And he doesn't need to prove anything.
And so yeah. he got that job, rightfully so. And again, the funny part about it was at the time, the people who were getting interviewed for the job or who at least were being mentioned as candidates were a guy that I worked with currently, a guy that I had worked with in the past, Mike Getman was another one. Caleb Porter at Akron at the time had asked me to work for him twice and we chose not to live in Akron. We just didn't. Caleb's a great guy, a good friend.
It just didn't fit.
Didn't want to live in Akron. And the other one was John Trask, who was at USC at the time, who had asked me to work for him at USC. And so here I am. I looked at my wife. I said, hey, look, regardless of who gets the job, there's a pretty good chance we're moving to Bloomington.
Right.
And so after a year in Wisconsin, Todd got the job and we moved down to Bloomington. Had a great experience. Obviously, 2012 being the pinnacle. You know, our first year there with Will Bruin on the roster and a couple, you know, other guys, Rich Balchin, Alex Purdy, you know, Mayer in the back. We had a lot of guys, Tommy Meyer in the back. We had a lot of guys, Louis Soffner in goal. We had a lot of guys that were very good in the roster already. You know, Phil Presser, who's now with the Indy 11, Lexi Carroll, who's an assistant at UIC, had done a great job stocking the roster. A lot of local young talent was there. And 2010, we won the Big Ten championship regular season.
Right.
2011, we lost to Akron, I believe, in the tournament. 2012, we won the national championship. And in 2013, we won the Big Ten tournament. So if you liken college soccer to a club in Europe, there's really three big trophies you can win. Your league season, you know, so you have the Premier League or the Big Ten regular season. You have a cup, the FA Cup, the German Cup, you know, Spanish Cup, whatever it is, which is our tournament. So you can win the Big Ten tournament. And then obviously you have Champions League, which is like the NCAA tournament. And so at the time in 2014, when the opportunity came to look at another job for me, I went to Todd and said, look, like we've won everything we can. You know, I've brought every trophy to this cabinet that I can bring. Did we bring them all in the same season? No, we didn't win a treble. No, we didn't win a double. But at the end of the day, you know, I added everything I could to that case. And so when the opportunity came to go to Stetson, for me personally, it was the right timing. You know, my parents lived down there. It was Florida. I was going back to Central Florida. I had friends there. So the opportunity was right. It was short decision. Unfortunately, Logan Fleck had passed away in the middle of July. And I interviewed within 10 days, you know, within 10 days, 2 weeks, the decision was made.
Right.
And I was literally pulling into town on Friday at 3 p.m. The Friday before they showed up on Monday. So players were coming on Monday and I showed up on Friday at 3 o'clock. And so, you know, one of the things that helped me was the preparation of IU in the preseason. You know, I had everything I kind of needed to start the preseason. I just changed it from red to green and changed the words from Indiana to Stetson, and changed some things around, but it was ready to go. It was a model that worked. You know, you tweak it, it's like anything else in coaching. You tweak it for what you need it for. And we started off well. You know, the first game we played, Elon at Duke's Classic and we beat them, and had a great result there. John Rennie was on site and he and I are old friends from working his camp and we were chatting a little bit about it. We had to play Duke the next day or the Sunday. And at halftime we were beating Duke 2-1. And I'd never forget walking into the locker room and the coach's room in the back and we sat down, shut the door and I looked at him. I go, we're really beating Duke at Duke right now, right? Like this is a real thing. And the coach was like, yeah, he's like, we are. Now, we went out and got our asses kicked in the second half. Full credit to John Kerr and his staff. And they were putting on subs that were in the national pool. And we were putting on subs who, you know, I didn't even really know their name because what role I was in. And so we ended up losing that game. But we had a really good start to the year, finished second in the conference, you know, and had a really good season. I got coach of the year and then went to the second season, lost a lot of guys, were rebuilding. And you know, for whatever reason, they decided to make a change after that, unfortunately. But that's college soccer.
That's coaching at the post high school level.
So that opportunity came to an end. Was able to work with a friend of mine, Andy Fleming, at Xavier for a year. Had a really good experience with him, learning kind of what the Big East was about and traveling to different places. And, you know, for all the times I played Virginia, we never played them at Charlottesville. So I was able to go to Charlottesville and we either tied or beat them. I can't remember, but we definitely got a result. And not only that, I got to see Tim Reynolds play acoustic the night before. That was really good. you know, that's the one thing about college soccer is, you know, you travel around quite a bit. And if you're not taking in the opportunity to enjoy the areas that you get to visit, there's really no purpose. And so we were out, you know, we're out the night before. We're sitting in this, you know, bar, for lack of a better way to put it. And there's this guy playing guitar. And I went up to buy a drink and I go, the guy's pretty good. Like, you know, what's the guy's story? And the bartender looks at me and he goes, well, I'd hope so. It's Tim Reynolds. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know who that guy is. In Bloomington, you used to get John Mellencamp. You know, John Mellencamp would do that back in the 80s. You know, he'd go to a place and not
just try out new material or whatever.
Get up there and play his guitar. So I've been to Charlottesville, got to go to Maryland, had never been to Maryland before because they weren't part of the Big Ten when I was there. So I got to see some unique places. Learned a few things about myself and, you know, running a program differently than a Yeagley had done it. That was one of my first, you know, examples of that because, you know, obviously Steve Burns at Michigan was learning. He had his thing, but we did a lot of stuff in IU way to kind of filter it into the program. Obviously it worked for coach, obviously worked for Mike Getman who worked for coach. So to see someone from the outside kind of how they do things and operate differently was good. You know, learned a few things there. And then the opportunity came for us to come back over to Indiana and work at Marion, which was a different experience than being the NAIA, which was good because you always kind of heard about the NAIA and it was different and they had good players and, you know, the rules were different and you could do things differently and blah, blah, blah. And yes, I'd say some of that is true, but there are still things you have to follow. And our league, unfortunately, was a 2/3 league. So we only got 8 scholarships instead of 12. So we were never going to compete probably nationally with some of these other programs, at least to the top level. But regionally we could compete obviously. And, you know, it was fun. You learned how to manage your money differently. They could, their academics required, different rules and how you count your scholarship. And it's important to keep kids academically strong. And you could get a lot of good players if they were smart. You could really work the money the right way. And so, things were going well there, and then the opportunity came to go into the club side of things. I was the goalkeeper coach at a MLS next to Catwell at the time a DA Academy, you know, doing that on the side of the Marion thing. And then the director came to me and said, hey, you know, do you want to get into coaching teams and we can pay you this? And it was similar to what I was getting paid. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, you know, this is going to be another step in kind of where to coach and how to coach. And got out right before COVID. It was
Right.
literally months before the shutdowns came, and so I didn't have to worry about the managing of the college team during all of that. We were a very good club with connections, you know, Zoom wise, training wise. We had, you know, I took kids in parking lots and did videos that we sent out to teams and players and goalkeeper training. And so the club managed, you know, the COVID situation very well. And coming out of that, I started coaching teams there and doing well. That's when I was getting into working with SRUSA at the time as another side gig, if you will. And then last year, you know, after the season, made the decision that, you know what? I can help a lot more people and have a lot more time to myself if I'm doing this more full time.
Right.
And so was able to now work with, you know, having, instead of having six or eight guys, I've got 16, 18 guys, you
Right.
know, and now you get to travel and you get to talk to families and you get to talk to parents and coaches and, you know, go see talent. I go recruiting now and I'm looking at players and people are like, well, who are you with? What are you doing? And I said, well, I'm with, you know, SRUSA and we're a recruiting consultant firm. And they kind of roll their eyes at you a little bit, like, oh, you're a recruiting company. I said, yeah, but look at it this way. That coach over there with whatever letters on his shirt, he's recruiting for one school.
Right.
I'm recruiting for every single one of them. All of those coaches that you see around those fields, plus the ones that aren't here, plus the ones that will never be here, I recruit for them. And they kind of look at you like, well, I never thought of it that way. And the reality is that's what we do. You know, we're the eyes for people that can't have the eyes there, you know, and I talked to our clients or potential clients at the time and say, look, our program works two ways. One, we come from your side. What are the schools you're interested in? What are you looking for? What are the things that will make you want to be at those schools? Soccer, academics, location, size, social atmosphere, whatever those things may be, right? Urban, rural, religious, not religious, you know, academic money, non-academic, whatever. You come up with your list over here. And we're going to massage that list with you. We're going to tell you this is unrealistic. This is realistic. These are the five or six you should be focusing on. That's part of it. I said, but the other side is we have information coming to us all the time. And so, what is it? Three or four times a year, we do a mass. Hey, what do you need in your program? What is it you're looking for? And so, as those pieces of information come in, we're able to look at it and say, okay, these 10 schools match what the person told me they want over here. So then I send this list of 10 schools that maybe they never heard of any of them. They might have heard of two or three. They might not heard any of them. And so you send it to them and you tell them, hey, here are 8 to 10 schools that I think fit what you're looking for. Tell me if you want me to reach out to any of them. They come back and say, these four or five look good. So now they have four or five more schools that they maybe had never heard of, but we're recruiting for them. We're connecting them. We're finding them their
Ernie,
fit.
I've always said it's pretty simple. It's match.com for soccer players.
That's a good
Schools on
idea.
one side, players on the other. They each have needs. They each have individual, unique characteristics. Who matches? Who matches what? But we, and it does happen. And I won't say we haven't sent out mass emails. It's happened. There's been certain situations where we felt it was necessary for the best interest of that player. And the player was so good that we thought other schools might, a broad variety of schools. But for the most part, I know you and I and our staff is just talking to our friends, finding players that match. If looking at our list, if we have players that match, we make recommendations. If not, we're on the lookout for them, literally at events. It's like, oh, this kid looks like the center back that so and so is asking for. And if they're not here, we
100%.
can find out the information about the kid. But you're exactly right. It's just trying to play matchmaker.
Yeah, I mean, I have a kid in my client list right now who, you know, I messaged him after the MLS Next event in Tennessee a few weeks ago and just said, hey, where are you with guys getting in touch with you, whatever. And the dad intervened and he said, well, what about Michigan State? You know, he really wants to look at Michigan State. So I picked up the phone and dialed Damon Rensing, the head coach of Michigan State, who's an old friend of mine, and said, hey, have you seen the Indy 11 team? Do you know this kid? He's like, well, remind me which one it is. I said, he's the one that scored in this game and he played this position. But he's like, yep, we like him. He's like, we'll talk to him this week. You know, so it's like even just knocking on the door to remind a coach, hey, like this kid likes you. Maybe you've seen him, maybe you haven't. And if you haven't, I'm letting you know that it's not wasting your time. And I think that's where it comes down to having someone like us in particular, who have been on the sidelines, who have done the recruiting, who understand the roles and the responsibilities or the player profiles, as they say now, for each program. That's where we can come in and say, this guy fits you. Like I'm not giving him to this school because I don't think he fits that coach's game model. But I
Right.
do think he fits what you're doing. Knowing what Michigan State's done over the last
Right.
15 years, he's your kind of guy. He reminds me of this player. He reminds me of that player.
Right.
You know, and the coach now bites and he's like, oh, okay, well, let me figure out more about it. And, you know, again, it may work out. It may not. But if it doesn't, then as we always say, a no is better than a maybe. And now the kid can move on to the next school, you know, and but I tell the kids the same thing. And this is really good where some of my other clients have been very good is it works both ways. If you're not interested in a school, you need to tell the school because they need to move on. And so, right. you know, if I get a letter from a coach that says, hey, I really like so-and-so, I let the kid know, hey, coach from this school, here's what the program's about. Here's what he likes about you. Is there a chance that you're interested in?
Right.
Kid says no, right back to coach. Hey, it's not for him at this time. If anything changes, I'll let you know. And I haven't had one coach, whenever I send that type of email or message back to them, I've not had one coach get upset. Not one. Because yes, they understand that it's not for everybody. They might not be at a program that everybody wants to be at. You know, I was that way at Marion. I'd throw a lot of darts. Some hit the board and some don't. And that's recruiting. That was an interesting experience with Todd Yeagley because he had always been at IU. He had always been a yes. Like very rarely does IU get no in recruiting.
Sure.
When IU comes after you in recruiting, typically they want you and you want them at that level. And 95% of the time, the answer is yes. Well, when we got to Wisconsin, he started getting no's.
Right.
And to see how someone of that ilk was able to handle that transition was interesting because, you know, he hadn't heard that a lot in recruiting. And I had, you know, with the University of Michigan, you know, we went after some of the best players in the country straight off the bat. You know, guys that end up being on national teams, guys that are now head coaches in college. And
they were going to Indiana. They weren't coming to you or where?
Oh, yeah, a couple of them did go to Indiana. A couple of them stayed. We were big in
UCLA,
California.
Right, right.
We were big in California. Right. Oh, I'll never forget, Don, we had several kids, and you'll understand this completely. We had several kids who it was us and somewhere in California, you know, a Fullerton, a UCLA, San Luis Obispo, whoever.
Right.
And the kid was really good. We offered him 80, 90, 100%, whatever. And the call would come. He's like, coach, I really like you. I really like Ann Arbor. I really like the University of Michigan, but I'm just a California kid.
Right.
That, I don't know, half a dozen times, you know,
sure.
But we heard no a lot at Michigan. And so I understood like, okay, next guy, next guy, right. next guy. And the unique thing that I really liked was so I went from coaching with Jerry Yeagley every day to now being in a suite of offices with a gentleman named Red Berenson. And for those who don't know Red, he basically was the Jerry Yeagley of college hockey. He was the John Wooden, the old sage, Dean Smith, pick the older coach with experience that you, in any sport that you want to go through. And so one day he comes in our office and he said, all right, I'm going to tell you a story. He's like, in the mid 80s, when they called me, I was coaching the St. Louis Blues. And they basically told me that if I don't come back to coach Michigan hockey, they're going to drop the program. Like it was that bad in the 80s. So he's like, all right, I'll come back. So he's like, when I got here, I chased around and he named off a plethora of who's who of American hockey. John Van Beesbrouck, Jeremy Roenick. There was another one or two guys that he would just mention, Eric Lindros. He's like, I chased these guys all around the country to come here and play. And he's like, I realized pretty quickly that if I was chasing them around the country, then I was going to have to chase them around Ann Arbor to get them to do what I wanted them to do. So he's like, I realized pretty quick that Michigan's a special place and I wanted people who wanted to be at Michigan. He's like, so I just went out and found, he's like, I went out and found the right guys. Not
right.
the best guys, the right, right. guys. He right. said, and the funny thing happened. I got the right guys for 3 or 4 years. I went to a couple Frozen Fours, and then all of a sudden, the Jeremy Roenicks and the Eric Lindros and the Van Beesbrooks, they're calling me to come to Michigan. Now they're the right guys. So
right.
it's like, you're the right guys at the right time.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good.
The best guys go.
Yeah.
Here's the kicker. So that made a lot of sense to me. You want people that want to be at your institution. They understand the roles and the responsibilities
right.
of being at that place. So that was really important. So I'm in a Chicago Fire game not too long after that. And Bob Bradley's, I'm sitting in the stands. There's some pregame going on and I'm sitting in the stands all by myself. And Bob Bradley comes out and he's the coach of the Fire at the time. And he sits down like, I don't know, 5-6 rows in front of me and off like the next section over. And so we're in Soldier Field. It's wide open. And so I walk down and sit down behind him and, hey, Bob, how you doing? And I've met Bob before at this point. I say, hey, how you doing, Ernie? Good to see you. You know, blah, blah, blah. So I said, I got a question for you, Bob. I said, how did you get Princeton? Princeton? How'd you get Princeton to a Final Four? And he said, almost identically to what Red Berenson said. He said, Princeton's a pretty unique place. He's like, guys have to understand what Princeton's about. Like, you can't just go get anybody to go play soccer at Princeton.
Right.
Like, so you really had to find the right type of person for that program. He said, and once we did that, same thing. Like it builds upon itself. But the key there is, and this is where I think the fit that we talk about all the time is very important. You know, people have to want to go to places and be happy there. You know, you can't, kids think they can be happy doing just about anything. But the reality is, it's their life now. There's not mom and dad there. There isn't your friend base that maybe you had at home. There isn't a girlfriend or a boyfriend that was with you before. How are you going to be happy if you're not culturally relevant to the area you're in? And so I think finding the types of schools and understanding as a coach, the right players to come into that program, but the players also understanding what they're getting into, you know, at the university.
Well, and here's the fun part, Ernie. For certain kids, like my son, it didn't matter. He moved to Amish country. He moved from California to Amish country mm-hmm. to play for BJ Craig. And because it was
BJ. Where did he play for BJ?
At St. Francis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when sure. BJ first got that kid.
All right. I like BJ. He's a good guy.
But he wasn't, it didn't matter. It didn't matter where he was. It could have been Alaska. If it fit the right route for his football, then it really nothing else mattered because the football was what made him happy. So I think about that kid. Sure. And then I think about what you're talking about, which is probably 80% or 90% of the other kids around that we deal with, where it's more of a holistic fit rather than, look, the soccer is the perfect fit for me. This is who I need to play for. This is where I need to be. And of course, there's no surprise that my son, I guess, is a coach now, right? Still coaching soccer because that's all he wanted to do, right? So yeah. I think the fun part of our gig and what we do is getting to know these families and sure. these kids and then going, look, two identical players that look the same, feel the same, everything. But this is a better fit for this kid. And this is a better fit for this kid. And if they tried to switch, it wouldn't fit. It wouldn't fit them. So
yeah.
That's the part I dig about what we do the most is it is boutique. It yeah. is labor intensive. It is personal for us to have these relationships with these families and with these kids and be able to try to then tap into the algorithm in your head after all of the experience that you laid out and yep. go, where seems to be the right fit? And by the way, which guys, gals, coaches, would I trust with my own kids?
Sure. That's a big part of it.
Right? And which is a part that we often overlook, right? School's perfect. The coach, look, every coach is a sweetheart while they're romancing you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody's sweetheart during the courtship period. And then we all have what we all know is the honeymoon period. Right. Then real life sets in and personalities aren't able to be hidden for very long because of the pressures that are on all of us,
yeah,
players,
100%.
Coaches, because of the life. So that's when it comes out. But you and I have seen, and guys like Andre and Chris and Danny and our staff, and Joe, all of them, Karen, we've all seen enough that we tend to know seems to be a good guy. And we've got company experience, right? Anybody placed a kid there? Yeah, I had a kid. What was his experience? Can we talk to the kid? Can these parents talk to the parents of that kid or whatever it needs to happen to make the family feel comfortable? Yep. That, look, we're not always going to get it right, and there's no way to predict everything. We're just trying to find the right fit for you, and at least it's an educated guess based on experience, a lot of
I think you're exactly right, and having the relationships amongst not only the coaches that we know, but like you said, amongst our own staff where we can bounce ideas off each other. You know, how many times does something come through Slack where basically it's like, oh, I've got someone talking to this school. Do we know the coaches there? You know, do we personal relationships? And I'd say, 99% of the time, someone on our staff knows someone at the places we're talking about, right? Whether it's a female coach, a men's coach, doesn't matter. You know, we've got enough experience through the ranks that we can use each other as resources. You know, you and I talked about that a few weeks ago with one of the clients that, you know, was working with someone else, but I was at the event, you know, and so now I'm bouncing schools for them. And, you know, we're a team. At the end of the day, here's what it comes down to, Don. When I was coaching at the college ranks, I would get a question from the parents all the time about what do you see your role as? You know, where do you feel your role is within what we're doing? And I said, my job is to allow you guys to have the most information to make the best decision possible. And so, you know, a kid would be like, well, I want to still go to look at this school, or oh, I still want to go to that school. I'm like, go. Now I was confident enough in what we had to offer that I could let someone go to another school and think that we were better. But at the end of the day, my own personal feeling was, how can you make a decision this important if you don't have all the information, right? And all the information was going to each school to visit. All the information was getting each offer. All the information was making sure that you were making the best decision for you and your family, to the point where one of my biggest losses in recruiting, I told him to go to another school. And he went, and he basically called. We offered him 80. We offered him 50%. Really good player, but he was small, really small. And I just thought he would a risk. He wanted 80. He's like, hey, this other school's offering me 80%. He's like, if you guys give me 80%, I'm definitely going to come. Blah 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 blah. And I looked at the head coach. I go, he could get broken in half the first game. Like, I mean, honestly, he played in the Big Ten. Like, he could come in here and literally in the first half of the first season be worthless for 4 years. Right. I said, so I think 50% is worth the risk. So the kid calls back the next day. I told him, I said, hey, take the 80. It's more money. It's a better school. It was. You're going to play sooner because the program was a year or two behind us in developing where they were. And you're going to play the position that you want. I said, go. Like, you're an idiot if you come here. And he kind of looked at me and he's, what do you think? I said, no, go. So he went. First season, he set the Big Ten assist. He went to another Big Ten school, set the Big Ten assist record, right? First season, motherfucker. But anyway, first season. So he goes on, has a great career, and that program has never been the same since. Always positive, right? So right. I'm down at Stetson a few years later, obviously, and I'm working with the women's lacrosse coach that's there, and she's getting inducted into this school's Hall of Fame. And on the same weekend, this player is getting inducted into that school's Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And I said, hey, when you go this weekend, tell my boy, I said, hello. Stayed in touch with him here and there over the years. And she comes back and she's like, what did you do to him? I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, he honestly wouldn't stop talking about you all weekend. He's like, you're the reason he went here. You're the reason that he had a career that he had. You're the reason, you know, after school that he's doing what he's doing and blah, blah. I'm like, I just told the kid the truth. Like, I just told the kid the truth. Like, I wanted him. He was a good player, but I couldn't afford him. You know, and so I advised him and his family. His dad was a pipe fitter. Like, so they obviously didn't have a lot of money. I was like, hey, go to this school. It's
better. Doesn't make sense for you. Right.
And so I just look at it, you know, now what we're doing is I'm trying to give everyone the best information possible for them to make the best decision they can. Can I help them along that path? Yes. I can tell you this program is this, this coach is this. You know, I can help you maybe get an extra few hundred dollars a year by asking the right questions or, you know, at the right time. Those types of things. And that's why I always tell families too is don't necessarily look at what we charge as an expense. Look at it as an investment. Now they've heard that before with youth soccer and that's a common theme. But the reality is there is an actual ROI on this one. Like if we can find literally $500 to $1,000 per year over 4 years, it covers what we charge, correct? And arguably, and you know this, every coach in the country has $500 to $1,000 in their recruiting budget right now. Because if they don't use it by July 15th, well, maybe they don't have it right now, but if they don't use it by July 15th,
right,
they just redistribute it amongst the current roster. Right. And so if it comes down to, hey, coach, I need an extra $750 a year to make it work. And that coach really wants you. Guess what?
They'll figure it out.
$750.
They'll figure it out.
And if it's a private school, they're going to go to admission and get you $2,000 a year. Like, right. I mean, that's the difference. And so, you know, a family's looking at it that way. And the other thing I tell families all the time too is imagine having a business. You have a lawyer on retainer. You have an accountant on retainer. So whenever you have a legal or a financial question, you just pick up the phone. Hey, can I do this? Hey, can I afford this? Hey, how can I do this? Hey, how can I afford this? The lawyer or the accountant's going to say, give you an answer, or they're going to find a way to help you figure it out. We're no different. How many people go through this process and don't know the answers to those questions? And so now you have someone on your Rolodex or now on your phone, whatever you want to call it. Basically, whenever you have a question about anything,
you just aged yourself, Rolodex.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
I mean, I actually used to have one. I think I cleaned out my desk about 6 months ago. But the reality is that you have someone on your phone now who at any given moment, whether it's a camp question, whether it's a legitimate email question, whether it's a legitimate invite question, whether it's a legitimate visit question, whether it's a financial aid question, whether it's an academic question, whatever.
Whether it's, do you know this coach or do you know that
coach
100%. Question? Is this school or that school fit me question? Or
anything.
Should I go to this camp or that camp question?
Yeah. And so whatever. I just try to tell them to look at it that way. You have an unlimited resource at your availability whenever you want.
Right.
And typically, as you know, answers can get done within 24 to 48 hours, you know,
right.
You know, I tell people all the time, you may email or text a coach and not hear from him for months. I email or text a coach, and if I don't hear from him within a day or two, it's odd.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like I might have to follow up, but the reality is I'm going to get an answer a lot longer or a lot sooner than you are. And
right.
Again, no's are better than maybe. So if we can figure out from a coach that they are or aren't interested in 48 hours, well, that helps the kid. And so there's a lot of value to what we bring. And that's the part that I tell people all the time is, I can get someone to clean my house. I can get someone, or I'm sorry, I can clean my house, right? I can clean my house. I technically can change my oil. I technically can do a lot of things, mow my yard. But if I don't know how to mow my yard a certain way to make it look a certain way, I got to hire a landscaper. If I want my house cleaned a certain way that I don't have the time or the resources for, I hire a maid, right? I don't necessarily know what types of oil to use or what bolts to put in where. I hire a mechanic. He changes my oil. It's a service. It's no different than anything else.
Right.
Yes, people can do what we do. I don't doubt that for a second. But do they have the same time? Do they have the same resources? Do they have the same opportunity to get information that we do? That's why you hire a service, because they can do it better.
One of my favorite stories, honey, I'm walking out to watch one of our clients play who had already been placed. But I was just checking in with the family. The dad said, are you going to be here? I walk over and the dad runs down, meets me on the field as we're walking up to the stands, walks across and goes, best part about you guys is once I wrote that check, I didn't have to think about it anymore. I knew it was between pretty much my daughter and the person who took care of her.
Absolutely.
And I just got to stay out of it until they needed another check written. Dad was busy, in other words, right?
Yeah, sure.
And obviously dad's watching his daughter play, or he's supporting his kid, but didn't have the time for all of the other things that were necessary, which is somewhere between 500 and 2,000 hours. People can argue, but it takes time. It takes time, and either you can hire someone or you can do it yourself, as you said. So Ernie, what do you got going for the rest of the summer?
Well, actually, I just spent the last probably 6 weeks working and running my butt off between scouting and getting my father settled in his new life, if you will. Just got back the other day from Florida and getting his house sorted and making sure it's ready for sale. So I'm kind of on the back end of that now, which is good. That has taken a lot of time away from what I wanted to be doing, which is being on the fields and seeing things. Worked the IU camp, both sessions. So now technically downtime, if you will. I still have to be in touch with our clients. I still am trying to get some new business, obviously, with what I've seen over the last few weeks. But definitely not traveling or planning to be out of town, for any extended period of time, probably until, September sometime.
Yeah, August is the month, for me. I used to do taxes in a prior life, and then August is my May. My goodness, April 15th has passed. There's still more work to do, but it's not what it was in
I'm actually debating whether or not I want to do this. I've always said my entire career that I wanted to go to New Jersey the week after Labor Day. So like Labor Day, Monday, like Tuesday of that week to like the Sunday the following week. Because the Jersey Shore the week after Labor Day is perfect. The weather's still really good. The towns are empty. And everything's on sale. And so I've never been able to do it because I'm always coaching, right?
Right.
I always said the first year that I'm not coaching, I want to do that. Well, last year didn't happen because of the transition and everything. And I'm debating this year whether or not I want to take myself up on that offer.
I think that trip. We did that. We went to the southern coast of Spain last year in September. It was great. There was no tourist season. The weather was still awesome.
It's
idea.
The perfect time to go because the weather's still, 80s, 70s, it's beach weather. There's no one there. And like I said, everything's on sale because they're trying to get rid of stuff from the season. And
so whoever's listening to this just got and made it this far into the podcast, just got a great travel tip from a New Jersey guy. Go in September.
If
you're going to go on vacation to the Jersey Shore.
And if you want to Disney, I can give you all the Central Florida Disney tricks too. I got those from when I lived there. Never go. I'll tell you what, the best day to go to a theme park is Christmas Eve. My wife and I went to Universal one time and literally we got to stay on the roller coaster. So we would finish.
Amazing.
We would get done and we'd come around and the guy's like, you want to go again? I mean, it's just because everyone's traveling and they want to be there on Christmas.
Right.
So Christmas Eve itself. Now, again, it probably depends on the day of it. But the reality was, 5 days of the week for Christmas Eve. Right. I mean, if you want to walk through an amusement park, I'll tell you what.
That would be when to do it.
So, yeah,
Ernie, this has been good, brother. I know you and me and Andre, we're going to get together again another week because we want to go over all of the changes that we've been hearing. So keep talking to your buddies. Keep collecting all the info. We're doing the same thing on our end. I've got one of my players who's on the national committee, so she's been filling me in a little bit. And then we've all been talking to our coaching buddies and trying to get as much info as we can because we would really like to be able to tell people what we see coming down the pike for the future. Big changes, folks, coming in college soccer.
I had a really unique conversation last night with a friend of mine. I've got one client right now who's very, very high-end in music. And so he's looking for a combination of a music and soccer program, obviously. And one of my best friends in Bloomington, who's also friends with Todd, his son went to the Jacob School of Music at IU, which is the top three in the world. Might even be one of the best, might be the best. And so I asked him straight up. I said, hey, would your kid have been able to play on the roster at IU going to Jacobs? And he was like, probably not. He's like, it's basically like being a two-sport athlete, the schedules and the timing and blah, blah. And I said, that's understandable. This kid's not an IU-level soccer player.
Right.
He may or may not be an IU-level Jacobs musician, but I just wanted to know if the balance could be had. But right. in that conversation, to go to what you were just talking about, you know, obviously I'm friends with Todd, and I need to call him to because he's sitting at the table. You know, he's a guy that's at the table of these conversations and to get some of that insight. You know, I think just real quickly, the biggest change for me and what we do is going to be the substitution rule. Yes, roster limits and yes, scholarship changes and all that stuff's going to affect it. But the reality of a young player now being able to get 10 or 15 minutes a half and develop over his first year or two is going to change dramatically based on their substitution role. We're now at Division One, where they come out, they're out, and you're going to have a lot of coaches now who play players, you know, as you see internationally, 60, 70 minutes a game. And when there's 20 or 30 minutes left, are you going to put on an unproven freshman? Or are you going to put on a third-year transfer that's played 2 years of college soccer?
Yeah, it's going to be a big change.
I
you're
think
right.
That's
it's going to change minutes.
What we do more than anything. And you're going to see then kids going into the portal quicker because they didn't play as much their freshman year. It's just, that's the one that is going to change the dynamic of the high school player the most. And I don't think a lot of people are talking about that necessarily.
No, I think the talk came out when the rule first talked about it, and then everybody's gone quiet. We need to go through a season of some experiences.
Yes,
but I
that's
think
part
you're
of it.
Right.
And now you're going to, now I think it's going to be important for kids to go somewhere and play so that in 2 years they become the transfer. You know, whether it's a gap year, whether it's a gap 2 years, whether it's a junior college, whether it's a D2 school, D3 school, whatever it may be, NAIA, go play. If you really want to have a chance to be at Clemson your junior year, you need to go somewhere and prove at that level that you can do it.
I couldn't agree more. We're gonna talk about that. We're gonna get together next week. So thanks, Ernie, for coming on, man. We've just been a good talk, getting to know you a little bit better in your career. And everybody, if they want to find you, Ernie, what's the best way for people to find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter, I think, or X, sorry, at Ernie Yarborough. I do a lot of stuff there. I have a Facebook account under my name. I don't hide my name or anything. Ernie Yarborough is on Facebook. I haven't Insta'd yet. I've been told I should Insta by a lot of people, so I might get into that soon here in the break. And then obviously Ernie@srusasoccer.com, or if you want to go even easier, mtsgk@live.com is my personal email. So
there we go.
Reach out to me any way you want, DMs, emails, you know, get my phone number after that, and we can talk from there. But I stay in touch with a lot of people all the time, so feel free to get in touch. Willing to help you with whatever questions you have, and hopefully help you and your family find the right fit for your daughter or son in the college soccer world.
Perfect. Thanks, Ernie. All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, Don. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right, bye.